Good morning.
Good morning.
This morning I'm going to give the fifth lecture on this text. And I just thought, reading it, I thought it would be good to remind you that birth and death, he's talking about our life, which we usually characterize as beginning at birth and ending at death. So there's that. But birth and death also means each moment. So each moment of your life. So just don't think of this as just being about this concept we have about what we call birth and what we call death. So this section that I want to talk about today is, however, do not analyze or speak about it, just set aside your body and mind, forget about them and throw them into the house of the Buddha. Then all is done by Buddha. When you follow this, you are free from birth and death and become a Buddha without effort or calculation. Who then continues to stagnate within the mind? For some reason, that line isn't in the text that we're chanting, but I must have missed it when I typed this. Anyway, it ends with, who then continues to stagnate within mind? Okay, so what are we talking about not analyzing or speaking about? What that is what's just previous to that, which is, he says, don't avoid death, don't desire them. This birth and death is the life of Buddha. If you try to get rid of birth and death, you will lose this life of Buddha. And if you cling to it, you'll lose the life of Buddha. So he says, don't dislike birth and death and don't long for birth and death. And he says, if you do that, you enter into the Buddha's mind. So that's what precedes this part that we're talking about today. So he starts out in this section, however, do not analyze or speak about it. So that's interesting. What he's saying, don't think too much about this birth and death. Don't think too much about clinging and pushing it away. We shouldn't reject our life. Sometimes when we analyze and speak about things too much, when we intellectualize about something too much, we get kind of far away from our life. We end up sideways next to our life, as opposed to actually immersed in and engaged in our life. We start to talk about our life to ourselves, about what it is, as opposed to actually living our life as it is. In Theravada Buddhism, there's this notion of getting off the wheel of birth and death. He could be also talking about that. So that would be about rejecting this life. There's also a way, in medieval Christianity, it seemed that there was this real desire to get out of this life and to go to heaven. So there was this rejection of life, that life was somehow the result of one's sins. So that would be a kind of thinking that Dogen would reject as a way to understand the nature of our experience in this life. Another kind of way I was thinking about it is when we are always asking ourselves to be perfect. I think we're more inclined to get caught in this trap, maybe, is this way in which we keep asking ourselves to be perfect. Perfection, in a way, is a rejection of life. Life is not a perfect state. The state of being a human being is not to attain perfection. The goal of Buddhism is not to attain perfection. So if we're constantly asking ourselves to be perfect, then that mindset in and of itself, a kind of analyzing and clinging to a certain way of thinking about things. What is perfection? Perfection is this preconceived model we have about how our life should be and what constitutes perfection. But life very seldom, or we very seldom live up to our preconceived ideas about our life. And so in that way, it's not very helpful. It's not helpful to beat ourselves up about not being perfect. So this is a kind of way that we analyze and speak about our life that is not particularly helpful. So another thing that we do is that we reject impermanence. This is in Buddhism is considered to be one of the real problems that we have as human beings. We don't want things to be impermanent. Actually, we really do want things to be impermanent, because if things weren't impermanent, which means that things change, interact, are not separate. If we didn't have interconnection, we'd like have a really big problem. I've talked about this before. It's like life as we know it could not exist. I don't know. There's nothing in this world that isn't in the process of change. Even rocks are changing. Imagine your life as a rock, and that's something you think is permanent, but we all know rocks are not permanent. But in our life of likes and dislikes, we're often caught in trying to hang on to the things that we like and getting rid of the things that we don't like, and thinking that the state of what we like could be permanent and the state of what we don't want or dislike could be permanent too, which is quite stressful for us. So if we have a good experience in Zazen, again, by the way, to just say a good experience in and of itself is some preconceived idea about what it means to have a good experience. What does it mean to have a good experience? A good experience in Zazen would be kind of, I'm saying conventionally, I'm not saying this is true, all right? But in our imagination, a good experience is some kind of feel-good woo-woo event, right? And then we think, oh my gosh, that's what enlightenment feels like. And so we spin out this whole story about what we're doing, and then we say, I've got to get that again. The next time I sit Zazen, I'm going to get that again. Like, how can I get that experience? And then you sit and you're meditating and it's not like that at all. You're like, where's my experience? What happened to my experience? I must be doing it wrong. So now you've got this whole cascading idea about what it is that we're doing. Zazen is not different from our life. So the kind of thinking that we have in Zazen is the kind of thinking that we have in our life. It's not like we come in and meditate and suddenly we're in this altered, you know, that we're in a different body, we're in a different mind, we're in a different world. It's your same old body, same old mind, sitting down, meditating. So what does that tell us about the nature of our experience? So that's part of what's going on in Zazen, is it's just letting go, not analyzing it, not having a story about it, just completely being present for that moment that's happening right then. It's not going to be the same moment that you had before, because these moments are fleeting, they're impermanent, they are not fixed. You can't make it happen. So you just present yourself for your experience as it is right now. So it really, in many ways, is not helpful to analyze things, to talk about things in a way that concretize them, that make them some kind of fixed experience. Now, of course, we do talk about things and we do analyze things. And on another level, there's nothing wrong with doing that. But you can see that sometimes it's a real problem. So we need to look at the way we're thinking about our experience. We're thinking about birth and death, we're thinking about practice, we're thinking about relationships, we're thinking about our life, we're thinking about the things that happen to us, and ask ourselves, you know, is this helpful? Is this actually helpful? We just did a class on Shanti Deva's Guided Bodhisattva Way. Shanti Deva's super intellectual, right? He's just like, and then you do this, and then you do this, and this is the way you think about it, and this is the way you do it. So that can be helpful as a way to kind of loosen up preconceived ideas. But you still have to discern, like, when it's appropriate to do that and when it's not. So, Shohaku Okamura has a series of lectures on Shoji, and one of the things he talks about is when he was a teenager, he was totally caught in this question of, why are we alive? You know, what is my function? What is my purpose? Just seemed to be completely obsessed with that. He could not figure out. He would go around and ask all these people. He couldn't figure out. And he never, every time anybody told him what they thought it was about, he would decide that they were wrong. So basically, there was like a no, it was no-win situation. And he had a friend of his who also was engaged in this dialogue with him, a peer. But then his friend became really sick with cancer, and he was dying. Shohaka didn't know that he was dying because the adults around him didn't say, you know, your friend's dying. But he knew he was really sick, so he would go visit him. And when he first started getting sick, he would visit him, and the two of them would like, oh, what is life? You know, what is the meaning of life? And they would have these big discussions. And then as time went on, his friend got sicker and sicker. And so one day he goes in, you know, and he's having this dialogue very intensely. He's trying to have this dialogue. And his friend says, I don't care anymore. I don't care about the meaning of life. He said, all I'm worried about is getting through the next moment. It's like, I don't have the energy to discuss the meaning of life. I just have the energy to actually engage my life as it is right now. So he, Shohaku had this epiphany about his way he was thinking about his experience, you know, that this constant digging around and analyzing really wasn't what was kind of where it was at. He was also at the same time going to Antaiji, which is the temple of his now deceased teacher, Uchiha Maroshi. So I'm sure that he had this Buddhist practice as well. So he realized that all this analyzing and tearing apart and angsting about the nature of his experience was not helpful. That actually what was more helpful was to really being present for his life as it is. So in Zen we say just this, things just as they are. Or Suzuki Roshi would say, things just as they is, right? So this way of kind of including the singular and the plural simultaneously. Our life just as it is in this moment, our things just as they are. So does this mean that we just kind of roll the punches and, you know, well, yes. But does it mean that we are pulled around by our life, that we make no decisions, that we just are caught in the things that are arising? And the answer to that is no. We are making choices. We are deciding this or that about the nature of our experience. But that decision-making process is based on what's actually happening, not what we would like to be happening or what we think the perfect thing would be or how we think we would be if we were perfect. You know, that we actually take into account the totality of our experience and the totality of the situation. That's things just as they are. That's responding to this moment just as it is. So we engage our problems. Our problems are the Dharma. Our problems are Dharma gates. If you didn't have any problems, boy, what are you here for? You know, if we didn't have any problems, we probably wouldn't be practicing. It just wouldn't. We'd be in some kind of very pure land. But we're not. We're in the Saha world. We're in this world of causes and conditions and impermanence and problems and not being perfect and not being enlightened and struggling and also happiness, right? We're also happy to go out. Usually happiness, my experience is that happiness often happens in community, in the sense of there's this way in which we are engaged with the world that we're engaged with. We go outside and we see a beautiful flower, or we see a beautiful flower arrangement, and we feel happiness about that. That's engagement with something outside of ourselves. We may be alone, but it's an engagement with with this world. Okay, so that's, however, do not analyze it or speak about it. And the next line is, just set aside your body and mind and forget about them. Set aside your body and mind and forget about them. Dogen has a phrase, Shinjin Datsuraku, and that means dropping or casting off body and mind. I don't think that here in Shoji that he used this phrase, Shinjin Datsuraku, to drop off or cast off body and mind, but I think that here he's talking about the same idea. So what is that? So dropping off body and mind is letting go of this self-centered life, letting go of this way in which we only experience our life as just this little kind of walking column or something. I don't know, this little walking bubble, thinking, talking, walking, eating, pooping bubble, you know, that wanders around and meets other bubbles, but doesn't actually permeate the other bubbles, right? So this dropping body and mind is somehow to go beyond that. In Genchō Koan, he says, to study the self, this is a very famous part of Genchō Koan, to study the way is to study the self. To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things of the universe. To be enlightened by all things of the universe is to cast off or drop off body and mind of the self, as well as those of others. Even the traces of enlightenment are wiped out, and life with traceless enlightenment goes on forever and ever. So let's take a look at this part of Genchō Koan. Okay, to study the way is to study the self. So to study Buddhism, to study a Buddhist way, has to begin with looking at the self. It has to begin with understanding something about the nature of the self. What is a kind of basic teaching about the nature of self in Buddhism? It is that we have no inherent existing self. We have a self, we have a personality, we have, you know, likes and dislikes, we have all of those things. But we do not exist in a vacuum. We do not exist disconnected from all of reality. We exist in an interdependent, interpenetrating relationship with everything. Our existence is tied into the whole universe. We depend upon the universe. The universe depends upon us. We are not separate. So what do we find out when we study the way? That's what we find out when we study the self. We study the self and we study the way, and we know that they're not different from each other. And that's why to study the self is to forget the self. Because when we actually study our true nature, that we are in this completely soup, the soup of life, together, swimming around in this pool together. And when I say together, I just don't mean human beings. I mean all being, the whole universe, swimming around together. When we do that, when we actually see that, we forget the self-centered self. So we forget that self. To forget that self is to be enlightened by all things in the universe. As soon as we can let go of this over-analyzing, over-thinking, over-concretizing, over-modeling, and contextualizing our experience, then the whole world becomes the Dharma. The whole world becomes a sutra. Then the whole world is teaching us. And when we can do that, we start to receive the teachings of the world. We receive the teachings of other people. We receive the teachings of our experience. Because the world is constantly telling us something. So yesterday, I was driving my car down Water Street in rush hour traffic, and there was somebody who wanted to turn into the street. And I will freely admit, my first impulse was to not let them in. And then I thought, well, that's silly. You know, why? So I let them in. I also had the thought, I wonder if, I know that when people let other people in front of me, it reminds me to let people in, because there were two cars there, it reminds me to let the next person in. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought to myself, I wonder if I let this person in, if the person behind me will let the next person in. Because I'm not going to let two people in. You know, that's my compromise. Two people are not getting in, but I'll let one person in. And sure enough, when I let the next person behind me let the next person in. Now, they might have done that anyway. So for me, you know, this whole kind of consciousness about the nature of my thinking about this is imperfect from a Buddhist model of perfection, right? It's imperfect thinking. Perfect thinking would have been never having to think about it. Perfect thinking would have been letting everybody in. This is my dialogue with myself about, you know, you're a Buddhist teacher. You shouldn't even have to think about this. Of course you're going to let everybody in. You know, you're not going to have be in the car thinking to yourself, am I going to let that person in? I don't want to. Yes, you are. Okay. You know, so this way in which we, it's an imperfect world. We all have to struggle with these things. So here's an opportunity to practice. Here's a chance for me to actually dialogue with this self that wants to be a separate self. This self that doesn't want to acknowledge that driving is a real interactive event. And that if we drive in a way that we acknowledge our interconnection and interpenetration with each other, our communication with each other, our shared experience with each other, we remember what it's like to be the guy sitting on the side street in the steady stream of cars that never stops. We remember what that's like. But we don't even maybe even have to think about it. So we just let that person in. But sometimes it doesn't work that way. But here's this Dharma gate to do the right thing. And it's okay that I thought about it. I don't have to beat myself up about it. It's okay that I thought about it. It was even better that I let the guy in, you know. And maybe next time I'll let both of them in. But the thing about it is, it's like, it doesn't have to be a perfect world. But we do want to return to this place of this teaching. This world is offering us a chance to respond, to see the teaching in everything that we do, to see the teaching and to hear that teaching and to respond to that teaching. So everything is, it's a Dharma gate. So to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things of the universe. To be enlightened by all things of the universe is to cast off or drop off body and mind of the self. So as soon as I let that guy into traffic, I was enacting what's already the truth, which is already that I am essentially part of this massive organism. You know, that is, I could say, is traffic in Santa Cruz. If I want to label some particular subset of it, I could say I'm part of this massive organism called, you know. So if I forget the self and actually become part of that larger event, then it's not even a question. Then there's this kind of harmony and flow that starts to happen from realizing that I'm part of this totality of this experience. I'm not separate from it. I don't have to protect myself. There's nothing threatening about letting this person come in from a side street. I don't have to be muscling my way through traffic. I can be okay with the guy who is muscling his way through traffic, and there was somebody who was doing that. You know, so it's like all those things can happen simultaneously, and it's all right. It's all right. That's just part of the imperfection of driving, right? The imperfection of driving can include all of those things. It can include me. It can include this other guy. It can include the people on the side street. It just can include the whole experience and a willingness to be, to allow it to be just as it is. So when I come up with my likes and dislikes and preconceived ideas about who's doing what, including myself, that's suffering. I bet everybody here has had that experience of having some idea about what somebody else was doing that wasn't okay, and boy, it was suffering. You know, it was suffering. So why not just alleviate our suffering by thinking about driving as this massive, interconnected, interpenetrating event? Try it. You know, try it. See how it feels. So when we do that, we cast off the body and mind of the self, this small self, this self that's defining the world only from our own point of view, as well as the self of the other. So that's a really important part there, because the self of the other is allowing the other person to be part of this totality. Often, we have these also preconceived ideas and judgments about the other person or about the other thing. The dislikes and likes it come around with that as well. So the guy who's muscling his way through traffic, maybe I don't like him. Maybe I just have all these preconceived ideas about who that person might be. I love it when you come up with those ideas and then you pull up next to them in traffic and look over and it's somebody you know and like. And then you have that immediate teaching of like, oh, that's interesting. I actually like this person. All those ideas I had about them were like suddenly they don't apply anymore. So this way in which we are inclusive, we include the other. Even the traces of enlightenment are wiped out. So even whatever trace we have, whatever ideas we have about enlightenment are gone, because we don't need to think about it anymore. We don't need to have a story about it anymore. And that traceless enlightenment goes on forever. So, just to remind you, this is just set aside your body and mind and forget about them. The next line is, throw them into the house of the Buddha and then all is done by Buddha. Throw them into the house of Buddha and then all is done by Buddha. So what are we throwing into the house of Buddha? I think we're throwing into the house of Buddha all these kind of preconceived ideas that we have, all this effort that's not particularly helpful. I also like the idea of throw, because there's this way in which abandon yourself. In Uji, Dogen talks about, and I can't remember the word in Japanese, but it's onomatopoeic, right? So the fish comes up out of the water and splashes down. So the word in Japanese has this sound of like coming like that. And this way in which just this abandonment of the fish coming up out of the water and then going back down. This completely being in our life just as it is. This throwing ourselves into things just as they are. So the house of the Buddha refers to, Dogen in other texts uses the house of the Buddha to talk about the Buddha way, to talk about Buddha Sangha, to talk about this kind of structure that we call the Buddhist path. So I would say that a way to think of the house of the Buddha would be to talk about Buddha nature, to talk again about this interconnected nature that we all share together in this life. So this is the house of the Buddha. Way in which we look to those who have come before us, who have done this path very sincerely and wholeheartedly, who have a deep faith in this path as being a wholesome path for us to live. So we throw ourselves into that company. We throw ourselves into that family. And when we do that, when it says all is done by Buddha, again, this isn't like all is done by some god named Buddha. It's that all is done by this Buddha mind, this mind of Buddha as the totality of the universe, as Buddha nature. So we just throw ourselves into this. We throw ourselves into the whole of our life. We throw ourselves into birth and death. We throw ourselves into this moment just as it is. So Shohaku's story about his friend dying, one of the things that he said about it is that what he discovered was just the causes and conditions of life is the reason that his friend had cancer. That there's no story, in a way, about it. There's you know, we don't like it or we do like it, and it just is in this moment because of various causes and conditions that have happened. And so how do we respond to that? How do we deal with this? So it's this, what I wrote in my notes here, is impermanence causes and conditions of all birth and death. This just things just as they are. This is another meaning for what Buddha means. To just throw yourself into this life. And as Shohaku said, and I was talking about earlier, he says, the 100%. Your life 100%. So can we be in this moment 100%? Dogen talks about juhoi, which means dharma position. This moment. This moment. So each moment has its particularity. A moment also has no duration, but we know in our minds we define a moment. We have a feeling about what a moment is. Maybe a moment is just, you know, like that. Maybe a moment is some time in our life. Maybe a moment is the appearance of this body. But we completely, 100%, throw ourselves into this moment. Dogen says about a dharma position in Genjo Koan, he says, it has no past and no future. And there's this way in which, conventionally, things, of course, have a past and a future. You have a past, you have a future. But your experience of the past and the future can only happen in the present moment. I mean, when you think about the past, where does that happen? When you plan for the future, where does that happen? It can only happen just in this moment. It can't happen any other time. That's what we experience, just this moment. And just this moment is absolutely, completely fleeting and impermanence. Just this moment is birth and death. The moment arises, it disappears. We can't even say when it came and when it left. So 100% being present for this moment. And simultaneously, this moment includes the totality of the universe. Everything is included in this moment. So can we hold both of those things simultaneously? If we include everything in this moment, that means that we can respond to this moment completely without being caught in our likes and dislikes. Because everything includes our likes and dislikes and then more. It includes the fish flying out of the water and coming down. It includes everything. And yet, it is just this moment. No past, no future. This moment. 100%. So that's that enlightenment, that's that engagement, that's dropping the self. That's being present for your life just as it is. That's what we're being asked to do. So that is all being done in the house of the Buddha by the Buddha. When you follow this, you are free from birth and death and become a Buddha without effort or calculation. I like this. Good marching. When you follow this, you are free from birth and death and become a Buddha without effort or calculation. I like the part about free from birth and death, but without effort or calculation, I think is tough. That's tough for us as human beings, without making effort or calculation. So the first part of the sentence, when you follow this, so this is our effort and our vow and our practice to follow this path. And of course, we have lots of definitions about what that means. We vow to do good. The three pure precepts are vow to do good, to avoid evil, and to benefit all beings. And every morning after Zazen, we chant the robe chant and we say, great robe of liberation, field far beyond form and emptiness, wearing the Tathagata's teachings, benefiting all being. So we say every morning, we say, this great robe of liberation, this totality, that this completeness, this way, this house of the Buddha, we are putting this on. And whether we are physically putting this on, if you have a rock sui, you put it on your head and put it on. But we are putting on the mind, we are reminding ourselves, we are putting on this mind of beneficial action, we are putting on this mind that we share as the mind of Buddha, we are putting on this mind that we share as the mind of the totality of the universe. We say, this great robe of liberation, I put this on, I wear this, I take up this vow. This vow that I'm taking up is a field. It's a vast field, far beyond form and emptiness. It's beyond likes and dislikes. It's beyond ideas. It is just this. It's completely immersing ourselves in our life 100%, the best that we can, within the context of our understanding of the teachings of the Buddha, which is Tathagata. Tathagata means thus come one and thus gone one simultaneously. So this coming and going, so this impermanence, this complete, holistic, holographic life that we live of suchness. And then this benefiting all beings. A more traditional translation would be saving all beings. But that has connotations for us, I think, that makes it hard. So this way in which we try to benefit all beings. So this is our vow. This is, we put this in front of ourselves every morning and say, I'm going to get up. I'm going to do this thing. So it's an interesting thing to do, to have a vow, to get up in the morning and have a vow to yourself. Doesn't have to be this. You know, it could be just, I vow to benefit all beings today. I vow to whatever it might be. I vow to love my kids more. I vow to not drive like a maniac. Whatever it might be, to make that vow, to remind yourself that this robe that you don, this robe that you wear, this vow that you take on, this totality of reality is this house of the Buddha. And then he says, so when you follow this, you are free from birth and death. So we're not caught anymore. We're not caught by this suffering of this and that. We're not caught by these ideas that we have. Because that's what birth and death essentially is, an idea. It's an idea. Birth is an idea. Death is an idea. Reality itself goes beyond ideas about what it is. If you say birth to yourself, what do you think of? You know, you think usually, if you're talking about yourself, you think of being born, which, by the way, I don't know anybody who remembers being born. So this event that we call birth, and then there's this event that we call death that we also don't know anything about, for the most part. We see it from the outside. We see death from the outside. But actually, we're experiencing death constantly because of impermanence. So these monumental events called birth and death are really ideas that we have. There is no birth and death in the way that we think about them. there is birth and death in the sense that things arise and fall. But the ideas that we have about them and the suffering that we have about them may not be particularly helpful. If we can let go of them, then we're free from the ideas that we have about them. And we're free to actually investigate what might be true, what might actually be happening. And then we become a Buddha without effort or calculation. Well, I think that part's a little tough. I have faith that that is true. But it's predicated on the idea that we set aside this body and mind in the sense that we drop body and mind, that we integrate ourselves with the totality of our experience. So that's our mandate. That's what we're being asked to do. And it's a difficult thing to do. We have a very strong sense of self, which in many ways is very good because we need to take care of ourselves. It's okay to take care of yourself. So, and we have to also pay attention to what that self is doing, what we're up to. So we make this effort to do this. We fall down, we keep trying, we get up. And that's our effort. And then the second word, calculation, is interesting. There are various translations of this. Calculation sounds kind of Machiavellian, which definitely would not be what we're up to. But calculation could also be something like just these preconceived ideas we have, these goals that we set ourselves that are not particularly helpful, like what I was talking about in Zazen, when we say, oh, I've had this enlightenment experience, I have to have it again. How can I get that again? So that's a kind of calculation. It's a kind of way of thinking about things that's not particularly helpful. Okay, so the last line I find intriguing. Who then continues to stagnate within mind? Who then, this is not in your text, who then continues to stagnate within mind? So this is how I understand what Dogen's doing here. He's kind of throwing down the gauntlet. He's offering us a koan. He says, who is it that continues to get caught in the self? That's the stagnating part. Who is it that continues to stagnate in this erroneous view of self within mind? This is not your mind. This is Dogen talking about mind as the totality of the universe. Mind as the complete function, right? The functioning, which in Japanese, he wrote another facet on this called Zenki, which means the whole works. This is the universe functioning as the whole works. That's what mind is here. So he's saying, who then continues to get caught? Who is the self-centered self that continues to get caught or stagnate within the totality of the whole universe's working? That's the koan. Who are you? Who is your true self? Who is the real person? Who were you before your parents were born? Who is this? Who are you? What is it? What is this? Thank you very much.